Now, we have read this evening, first of all, from that ancient book of Job. I take it that you are acquainted with that book. Sometimes we are reluctant to study those longer books in the Old Testament. But I want to say straight away that the answer to Job's problems was not an explanation about God, as the three so-called friends and Elihu had given in the earlier part of the book. It was not an explanation about God, but rather a revelation of God. And so at the beginning of chapter 38, we read those words, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind." So it's quite evident that in these circumstances, God must speak out of the storm. Let's not forget that this is how he spoke to Israel on Mount Sinai. And when we go back to Exodus chapter 19, we read that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud. And centuries later, to Elijah the prophet, we read there in 1 Kings and chapter 19, "And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. And after the wind, an earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire." We move over to the book of Ezekiel, and we learn that Ezekiel saw the glory of God, and he saw it in a storm, and he heard the voice of God speaking to him. Experiencing this majestic demonstration of God's power made Job very susceptible to the message that the Lord had for him. The Lord's address to him, and we took time to read at least a significant part of it, it really extends right the way through to chapter 41. The Lord's address to Job centered on his works in nature and consisted, now you can check this out, I believe it consisted of 77 questions. And those questions are interspersed with divine commentary relating to those specific questions. And the whole purpose of this questioning, the whole purpose of this interrogation, was to make Job realize his own inadequacy and inability to meet God as an equal and defend his cause. So that's the background to those verses in chapter 38. You see, Job had said, "Then call," and the word really is summon, "then call thou, and I will answer, or let me speak, and answer thou me." And the Lord now, at this particular point, the Lord is responding to the challenge of Job. And that address may be summarized in three questions. Question number one, can you explain my creation? And that would embrace the first 38 verses of the chapter that we read from, chapter 38. Can you explain my creation? Then from verse 39 of chapter 38, down to verse 30 of chapter 39, the question would be, can you oversee my creation? And then when we come to chapter 40, it begins really at verse 6 and takes us through toward the end of chapter 41, the question is, can you subdue my creation? And there, of course, we're introduced to those creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan. It's an interesting study there in its own right. So question number one, can you explain my creation? That concerns God's power and his wisdom in bringing the universe into being. Can you explain my creation? Question two deals with God's providential care over his creatures. And then, as I've suggested, question three centers on two creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan, that then defied man's ability to subdue them. I want to direct your attention to the fact that God is now called the Lord. In other words, Jehovah. And that is a name, except for one odd reference in chapter 12, that is a name that has not been used in this book since the opening two chapters. And in that passage that we read together, you might be glancing at it as we go through those verses, the Lord begins with the creation of the earth. And that takes us from verse 4 down to verse 7. The question posed is this: where wast thou when I laid the foundation of the earth? And in this little passage, the Lord compares himself with a builder. And as a builder, he surveys the site. He marks off the dimensions. He digs the footings. He lays the cornerstone and he erects the structure. And so we have another question: who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? You can see, therefore, that the Lord is presented as a builder. Creation was so wonderful that the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. I think you will agree with me that in this particular verse, the sons of God would refer to the angelic beings. We have them introduced to us in chapters 1 and 2 of this very book. So they are the sons of God. I'm sure you appreciate that in these poetical books, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, we have the poetic form, not meter or melody. And it's a question of what is known as parallelism. So sometimes we have a statement made at the beginning of a verse, and that's followed in the latter part of the verse by a second statement, and that second statement may reinforce the first statement, or it may be exactly the opposite. And so I believe that here we have a verse that establishes that angels sing, because I judge that when he speaks about the morning stars, he's not thinking of the stars in the sky, because they were not created until day 4. But he's using that as another way of speaking about angels. That's just an aside. These mighty angels, the same ones mentioned, as I've said twice in the prologue of the book, were fascinated observers when God provided the firm foundations for the earth. And they rejoiced when it was done. I pose the question: did they know at that particular stage that the earth would be the primary sphere of their ministry when God created his creation? The Lord then moves to a consideration of the seas. That takes us from verse 8 down to verse 11. And the image here is not building, but rather birth. And the sea is described as gushing forth from its mother's womb. We read in verse 8, when it brake forth as if it had issued out of the womb. And its storms and its fury in his almighty hands are really but the cryings of a newborn babe. And he wraps it in the swaddling clothes of clouds and thick darkness. So we read in verse 9, when I made the cloud, the garment thereof, and thick darkness, a swaddling band for it. You will appreciate that the limits of the seas were themselves set by God. Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed. The next aspect of creation that God spoke of was the sun. We have it here referred to in verse 12 as the day spring. And this section takes us from verse 12 down to verse 15. And here, God presents himself, pictures himself as a general commanding his troops being the heavenly host. Had Job ever told the sun to rise and to dispel the darkness? Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days? That's the question posed. And caused the day spring to know his place? And then the next 11 questions, and that takes us from verse 16 down to verse 24. Those questions relate to the vast dimensions of creation. Had Job ever taken a walk in the depths of the sea? The question is, hast thou entered into the springs of the sea? Did Job know how far to go to find the floor of the ocean? Or hast thou walked in the search of the depth? I suppose this is a little bit of geography. I understand that the greatest depth so far measured in the Pacific Ocean is 35,810 feet. There are some of you who don't know those imperial measures, so that's 10,922 meters. But I'm just emphasizing the fact that the greatest depth in the Pacific Ocean is far deeper than the highest mountain on the earth. And then, could Job calculate the reaches of the east and the west? Well, one of my favorite verses is found in Psalm 103. As far as the east is from the west, so far hath he removed our transgressions from us. And we can't measure the distance between the east and the west. But were the horizons then too much for Job to measure? Hast thou perceived, he says, the breadth of the earth? Declare if thou knowest it all. Did Job understand the heights where the snow and the hail were stored until God needed them? Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow? Or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble? That's an interesting expression, isn't it? The time of the trouble, mentioning hail. I wonder whether our thoughts are taken to those tribulation days. But they're all reserved. God has them in his hand. Did Job know of the places where God kept his lightnings and his winds? Because verse 24 says, by what way is the light parted which scattereth the east wind upon the earth? Then, how much did Job know about the rain? That would take us from verse 25 to 28. Did he know how to plot its course so that it would accomplish the purposes of God? To cause it to rain on the earth where no man is, on the wilderness wherein is no man, to satisfy the desolate and waste ground? Was Job able to father the rain and the dew so that the land would have the water where it was needed? Hath the rain a father? Or who hath begotten the drops of dew? And then the Lord, he turned. You see how fully embracive is this questioning of Job. The Lord turns from the spring and the autumn rains to the winter hail and frost. Did Job understand how the ice was born? Out of whose womb came the ice and the hoary frost of heaven? Who hath gendered it? And Job's attention was then turned to the heavens. That would embrace verses 31 to 33. There's reference to Pleiades, that's the seven stars, to Orion, the hunter, and the various constellations, Maseroth, and Arcturus, that's the bear with cubs. Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven? Did Job understand the laws that govern the movement of the stars and the planets? Well, astronomers may study the heavens, but they cannot control them. I did read from 1 Corinthians and chapter 15, because Paul would remind us that there are celestial bodies and bodies terrestrial, but the glory of the celestial is one, and the glory of the terrestrial is another. There's one glory of the sun, and another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for one star differeth from another star in glory. You see, celestial, in that passage in 1 Corinthians 15, celestial and terrestrial bodies are contrasted in view of the fact that each partakes of a particular type of glory. And it's a glory that is suited to the realm in which it is placed. I'm sure in your first, I think you've had one study, haven't you, thus far? I'm sure you have appreciated that the basic idea in the word glory is really that of manifestation. So when we speak about the glory of God, it is the manifestation of his being, his character and his acts. And in the context of 1 Corinthians and chapter 15, we learn that just as there is a difference between the splendor of the heavenly bodies and bodies which are associated with this earth, so there is a difference between the body of the believer and the one which he will have after resurrection. I take it that by that expression, bodies terrestrial, Paul is referring to geological structure. He's thinking about mountains and volcanoes and glaciers and cliffs and islands, because all display beauty, but they don't display radiant glory like those celestial bodies. Paul then refers specifically to the heavenly bodies, and each has its own unique and peculiar glory. And the difference between the glory of the one and the glory of the other is not one of degree, but rather of kind. For one star differeth from another star in glory. And all really are radiant examples of the variety of God in creation. Each radiant body is distinct in itself, and we have to appreciate that God is not a God of repetition. I have digressed because we were taken in Job chapter 38 to those starry heavens. But returning now in conclusion, in this part of the message, to Job chapter 38, in verses 34 to 38, the Lord directs Job to consider the clouds. Could Job order the clouds to give rain? Canst thou lift up thy voice to the clouds, that abundance of waters may cover thee? Was the lightning his servant reporting for duty? Canst thou send lightnings that they may go and say unto thee, here we are? You see, creating all these things is one thing. And our brother in his thanksgiving this evening reminded us that all things were made by him. We're now in John chapter 1. We're thinking of the Word, the eternal Word. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. And another very interesting verse, which we find in Psalm 33, is this: by the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. So creating all these is one thing, but maintaining them for man's good is something else. And so the Lord next moves in speaking to Job into a series of questions concerning his providential working in the world. And you will notice, if you look carefully, that he moves from the inanimate sphere to the animate. And those second and third questions are these: can you oversee my creation? And then finally, can you subdue my creation? Now we want to turn to consider in a little more detail the declaration of the glory of God in creation. I'm sure you've noticed that Psalm 8 is completely enclosed in an ascription of worship, because it begins and it ends with the same lovely words: O Lord, that is capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, that is Jehovah, O Lord, our Lord, capital L, small O, small R, small D, that is Adonai, that is sovereign Lord. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. This word excellent, well, it could be translated in a variety of ways. Perhaps majestic is another alternative. And then what about this expression, thy name? In other words, it's referring to thy character as expressed in the works of creation and of providence. And it's the name by which he himself has made himself known. And then we come to this lovely expression: who has set thy glory above, or perhaps upon, the heavens. So God has clothed the heavens with a glory which manifests his own glory. And David says, when I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers. So really, God here is viewed under the figure of an accomplished handicraftsman. The moon and the stars which thou hast ordained. You will appreciate that since no mention is made of the sun in this particular passage, it tells us really that David is contemplating the skies by night, as doubtless he often did in his shepherd days. And David considered the infinite vastness and the splendor of the heavens, the immeasurable distances of space, the brilliance of the moon at night, and the innumerable stars. I should add, not innumerable as far as God is concerned, but the innumerable stars, all keeping their appointed places, because we read those words, which thou hast ordained, all keeping their appropriate places in the firmament. Jehovah had established that vast solar system, and he had established it for his own glory. But you see, such contemplation is most humbling to man. And therefore, David has to add the words, What is man that thou art mindful of him? And brethren, we are so thankful that God took note of ourselves in our lost condition and made provision for our salvation. What a wonderful Saviour we have in the person of God's Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. When we turn over to Psalm 19, we find that it is in one sense a contrast, and yet on the other hand a complement to Psalm 8. Because Psalm 19 is a consideration of the same heavens, but a consideration of them in the daytime, when the sun is shining in its strength. And here in Psalm 19 again, the glory of God is told out in the wonders of creation. Verses 1 to 6 of Psalm 19 really present the revelation of God in the heavens. When we come to the next little part of the psalm, it's the revelation of God in the scriptures. And the last part of the psalm is the revelation of God to the soul of the individual. But we're focusing attention on those opening verses, the revelation of God in the heavens. And verses 1 to 4 are really emphasizing the power of the witness. And then, although we didn't read them, and we may just touch upon them in a moment, verses 5 and 6 tell us of the path of the Son, the power of the witness and the path of the Son. So we have this wonderful statement in the opening verse. I'm sure we've quoted it on many an occasion. The heavens declare the glory of God. So really, David is now adding to the statement of Psalm 8 that God has set his glory above the heavens. He's adding to that statement by telling us that the heavens themselves demonstrate the fact that heavens declare the glory of God. And the firmament showeth his handiwork. So the great expanse of those heavens show forth his glory, and show forth his glory at all times. This good word, handiwork, which in our authorized version is spelt with a Y, this word handiwork is perhaps rather handwork. And I understand that the word may be translated needlework. And so in a very wonderful way, we can say that the Creator has embroidered the heavens with the beauty and the splendor of these heavenly bodies. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. So this testimony to God in the heavens, this testimony needs no translation. It doesn't need any communication on the part of man, because it speaks directly, and speaks directly to all men everywhere, day and night. So both day and night, each has its own message. Verse 3 tells us, there is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. I don't know how you read this, but the authorized text suggests that wherever men are, and whatever language they may speak, the declaration of the heavens may be understood. No speech, no language where their voice is not heard. But in fact, the verse may be understood to say that there is no speech. There is no language. In other words, there is no audible word. And yet, without these, the message still goes forth. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. So no measuring line can determine any limits to the scope and to the sphere of their testimony. There's certainly no geographical barrier to the witness of the heavens. Their unspoken word goes out to the extremities of the globe. And then we are told that in them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun. You will appreciate that in these poetical books, which we've already named, metaphorical language is being employed. Figurative language, metaphorical language. So when we read, in them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, the idea is that the sun arises out of his tent in glory at the dawning of the day. And having crossed the expanse in splendor, we know, of course, that it's the earth that goes round itself. But nevertheless, in this particular passage, it's speaking about the sun crossing the expanse in splendor. Then the sun returns to his pavilion in glory in the evening hour. So that's the figure that is being taught us here. And then it's amplified, really, in verses 5 and 6, and we're told there in more detail about the path of the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race. So here we have two similes. First of all, the bridegroom, and I take it the emphasis is that he himself is quite exquisite in his apparel. And then the second simile is that of a champion rejoicing or if you like, exulting in his ability. So this passage is telling us that the sun comes forth with joy and gladness like a bridegroom. And he appears as a valiant champion to run the race and then later return in glory. His going forth, says verse 6, is from the end of heaven and his circuit unto the ends of it. And there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. So what we are being told is that the sun travels the circuit unceasingly, witnessing to the glory of its creator. And not only that, but dispensing warmth impartially. And that is done to all men of whatever land or language. Now finally, that verse in Romans chapter 1. I'm sure we have quoted that verse on many an occasion. The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So we've looked into the book of Job. We have considered what David has to say, both in Psalm 8, which of course is a messianic psalm, as well as directing ourselves to the glory of God in the heavens. Psalm 8, and we've considered Psalm 19, and in passing, we did go over to 1 Corinthians and chapter 15. But what about Romans chapter 1? What does the Apostle Paul have to say? Perhaps we should, this would be one of the verses that we learn by heart. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, and please note these words, so that they are without excuse. We have seen that long before Paul made known the wondrous truth of this particular verse in Romans chapter 1, the psalmist had penned similar thoughts. In other words, creation is not dumb, and the voice of the natural world. That voice is loud and it's clear. And the things of God that are unseen by natural state, natural sight, are stated here to be clearly seen in other ways. And the things that are made are evidence of God's eternal power, and they are proof of his eternal glory. Let us bear in mind that at no time in man's history has there ever been an absence of testimony from creation. The handiwork of God in creation is not beyond the comprehension of man, even in his most primitive condition. Let us bear in mind, brethren, that the power of God is eternal. It is always existing. He is the omnipotent God. That is one of the attributes of God. And what is true of the Father is true of the Son. The power of God is eternal. He is omnipotent. And by his power, he brought all things into being. So these things that are made bring the attributes of God within the range of man's comprehension. And so man is without excuse. And man is expected to acknowledge that there is a power outside of himself, a power on a far higher plane before whom he as an individual must bow. And to ignore or to deny the clear testimony of the eternal God in creation leaves man without excuse and confirms his guilt. Now we trust the Lord will bless his word to our hearts for his name's sake.